I'd like to call to order the Oregon Board of Accountancy's board meeting, October 19th, 2021, and it's 8:31. Good morning, everyone. My name is Nancy M. Oliver, Chair of the Board of Accountancy. I'm calling this meeting to order. This meeting is being held via Zoom video. Please be sure to mute your mic through the Zoom or mute your phone if participating by phone. If you wish to speak, please unmute. Please do not use the chat room for any discussions. Should any technical issues arise, this meeting will be paused until it is resolved. Julie, will you please now take roll call?
Yes. Yes. So Nancy.
Oh, we have terrible feedback. Sorry.
Nancy, present. Deanna. Joe Sullivan.
Present. Via Zoom.
Thank you. Haley Lyons.
Present via Zoom.
Jason Robinson.
Present via Zoom.
Stu Morris.
Present by way of Zoom.
Sorry, we have so many guests joining that the list is moving. Kimberly Fast.
Present by phone, Stu, not video.
Angie Hines. Jeremiah Lumber.
Present via Zoom.
Joel Parks.
Present by Zoom.
You know he's there.
Present by Zoom.
You know he's there.
Present by Zoom.
Thank you, Joel. And then we have, did I mention that the board members or staff? Oh, Raul, sorry, Raul, I see you waving.
I am here. Thank you. Via Zoom.
Thank you. So, yes, we have Sherry McPherson.
Present.
Tanya Moffitt.
Present via Zoom.
Elizabeth Ulmer. Present via Zoom. Logan Steele.
Hello, present via Zoom.
Amanda Fells.
Present via Zoom.
Ryan Wilson.
Present via Zoom.
Nicole Hazelbaker.
Present via Zoom.
Eric Mosier.
Present via Zoom.
One more joining us right now. Oh, actually, two more. I'll let them connect. So we have Michael Van Dyke. Can you announce that you're present? Maybe not yet. David Brockmiller. We have some technical difficulties. Did I miss any of our guests? That's all I've got, Nancy.
Great, thank you, Julie. So the first item up on our public agenda is to review the agenda, make sure that there's no changes, and approve it. So I'll look to the board members. Is there any adjustments or changes to our agenda? Okay, hearing none, I'd like to call for a vote to approve the agenda. Is there any motions?
I'll move.
Second?
I'll second it.
All in favor of approving the agenda, state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carried. Item number three, we have from the Complaints Committee, the BOAC. This is informational only. And, looking on the screen. Tanya, was there any information that you covered? So I'm seeing a no there. Great. This was information only. Does anybody have any questions? Great. Then I'm going to go ahead and move right into our work session. And we have a number of items today, all of which need some careful consideration. The first item up for discussion is implementation of fingerprinting requirements. This does require a vote by the board. And so I'm going to ask board staff to give us a introduction to this, but you should all have received a handout on the information of fingerprinting, and the request is whether or not we are going to direct staff to gather information on the process, cost, availability, and timeline if we want to go forward with fingerprinting and criminal background checks. So Kimberly, I'm going to turn this over to you to provide us a little bit more narrative to go with this.
Okay, hey, that's kind of, I'm going to have to hang up one thing and go to the other, so give me a couple seconds. Maybe Julie, can you start with me so I can figure this out?
Yes. So as we're looking at the security issues and other issues that may arise as we move further along with our online licensing system, we have identified this as one potential area where we'll no longer have the ability to require like a notary public for applicants for licensure or for the exam. There really isn't any other way. I mean, we can require like an upload of their identification, but there's no way to match the person with, you know, the ID, so there's no way for us to tell this fake. So we've had a rule for a long time that the board could require fingerprinting. It's just whether or not you'd like to roll out, you know, implementation of that rule along with the online application process. We would need to know up front so that we could include that in our specs for the new system.
Just to clarify, Julie, it's in the statute, not in the rule.
Oh, statute, sorry. Thank you, Andy.
Thank you, Julie. So, board members, want to open this up for discussion?
I have a question. This is Stu. You know, we've got, what, 6,000 accountants? Are we going to consider bringing all these in at one time, or are we going to, should we be thinking about staging it so that the newbies are getting new licensures to be licensed first? I mean, I'm concerned about the volume.
I think this is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm believing that this is in relation to new licensees, not going back and doing a retroactive application, but only for new ones. Am I correct on that, Julie or Kim?
Well, that's part of the discussion that you'll need to have, because yes, for new applicants, that would be, you know, probably top priority, but it wouldn't necessarily be limited to that. You could certainly, with renewal, have, you know, I don't know how it will all look. That's, you know, Kim may have more to say, Angie may have more to say, but we'll no longer have anything tangible, right? There won't be a signed application that will be a box attesting to typing your name, you know, identifying records like that. So it's that level of security, making sure that you have the right person, if there's any background question that you have.
Thank you, Jim.
Your point for...
Jason?
I don't see a point of doing it for the renewal process. So we've already identified the people as they are, initially, to the notoriety.
And thank you, Jason. Okay, I just want the record to show that Dan Dustin has joined our public session here. Welcome, Dan.
Morning.
Haley, did you have something you wanted to add? I see that you've unmuted yourself.
Yeah, I have a question. When I first read this, the first thing that popped into my mind, so I want to clarify, I'm not sure that's what it says, but is that if we were to roll this out on new licensees, the intention would be that it would be applicable to everyone. This wouldn't be granting the board the authority to pick and choose who has fingerprinting and who has a background check, right?
That would be my
yeah.
Thing too, yes.
Yes.
Thank you, Haley. And remember, what all we're deciding on today is whether or not to gather information. We are not voting today on whether or not to implement this. It is just to gather information on process, cost, availability, timeline, for us to then look at it further to determine at a later date whether or not this would be appropriate for the board to implement. So this is just a discussion of, do we want to gather more information on this? You know, yes or no. Other comments or concerns from the board? Joe?
Yeah, there are a whole lot here, so I would say, you know, I would recommend following the recommendation to gather more information. I'm sure we'll have additional questions once we have that information, but at this point, I would follow the recommendation.
Thank you, Joe. Raul or Deanna?
Yeah, let me get this straight. And I got to remind you, because I got this in the right a while back. But the process right now, when we sit with the notary, how do they identify us? We present our license, is that correct? Our driver's license? So at that point, they determine who we are, right? And they sign that, they sign the document, and where we go. But this fingerprinting and even the term criminal background checks, are we looking for something else besides identity when we do that? Are we looking, or is that done as well right now as far as a formal background check? You know, are these, you know, okay, these people are real, but are we criminals? Are we looking at that as well now? Because this new proposal seems to indicate that that's what we'll be doing as well.
That's a good question, Raul, and my little bit of an understanding is that when you do a fingerprinting, it's a background check. You know, it's Raul, you used to work at Secretary of State. You know, when we audited the Oregon State Letter, we had to go get fingerprinted and have the criminal history background check. And so it's, you know, it's just one of those things that in certain environments, you know, they do the criminal history background check. Now, with that stated, there's different levels of a background check, okay? And so I think that is some of the information that if we agree that we want more information, that's one of the elements or questions that I would have is that what level of a criminal history background check are we going to go through? Because it can be quite extensive and quite expensive. I can tell you that in teaching the forensic investigative accounting class at PSU, that in order to get into the class, it was a prerequisite. They did not have a criminal history background, and they had to submit enough information that Portland Police Bureau could do at least a desk review on each and every one of the students that was entered into that classroom. So that's what I'm saying. There's different levels. So, you know, and what might those levels be? So that would be definitely something that we should add to the list of questions for the board staff to research should we want to go forward with this.
This is Jim Morris. I would also like to know, while they're doing that, how many issues have we had in the past with criminal accountants? I mean, is there a precedence for, are we running into a group of people now that are more crooks than good ones, or, I mean, over my odd years that I've been with the board, I really haven't seen but a couple what I would call criminal, and they were dealt with, but, you know, what cost and what are we going to get out of this? Mm-hmm. I want to make sure there's some payback to the board, an improvement of something or a reduction of something, and that's part of what I'd like them to look at.
Okay.
I just want to be clear that this is something we are adding on top of identifying the individual. Is that correct?
Kimberly?
I'm sorry, can you repeat that, Ralph?
Yeah, I just want to be clear. Is this this background check, whatever level it might be, this is something we are adding on top of identifying the individual?
Well, I think what we were looking for when we decided to kind of look in this direction was that when we go to a full-on when we go online licensing, we'll have the only way to really verify them will be through this background check that will give us a little bit more information than we would. They can just type in anything at this point. Right now we have paper and we have other ways to kind of identify them. So that, I think that's because we're going electronic on everything, that's why we're going with that.
My brief comment on this is I think it absolutely should be looked at. I guess I'm a little taken aback that we haven't been looking at fingerprinting and taking a look at other boards, not only at the state level, but I can tell you from the bar level, you know, fingerprinting has been, you know, we do that how long ago that's been done. So this is a little bit of a shock to me that this wasn't done prior to. So I think we need to take a hard look at it and agree that, you know, you don't need a full-on background check, but there is some level that even at the most minimum level, that needs to go in, or at least be looked at in terms of cost and things of that nature, particularly in keeping in compliance with our obligations to protect the public.
Thank you, Deanna. So, what I'd like to do now is entertain a motion on whether or not we want information gathered on the process, cost, availability, and timeline, bringing back to the board for consideration whether or not this should be implemented, and whether or not, you know, like the different layers of a criminal history background that we could do, what are other state boards doing, or other professional licensing entities doing, and how that information will be used by the board. So do we have a motion on the table?
So moved.
Is there a second?
I'll second.
Okay. So for a vote to yes, perform research and gather information and bring it back to the board, state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is carried. Okay, the next on our list is proposed statute rule changes. The first one up is the Division 001.
Nancy, I see that there's a Katie Fass that has joined. Do you see her on there?
Oh, okay. Great. So let the record show Katie Fass has joined.
And then was Nicole already recognized?
Yes.
Here?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, thank you. So I can start. Division 1 doesn't have a lot of changes. Basically, we change our date every year to have the most recent rules, procedural rules. So that's pretty much it. So yeah, there's a date change on page 3 and page 1. I believe that's it for Division 1.
Thank you. Is there a motion to accept the changes as presented?
Mr. Stu, I move that we accept the changes as presented for Division 1.
Second?
I'll second the change run.
Okay. For those in agreement, state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion is passed.
Nancy, can I clarify? I think by accepting these, we're just accepting to begin the rulemaking process, right? We have to provide public notice and go through all of the. Okay. Thank you.
Yes. So it's that what the changes that you have presented are the board is in agreement with to go through the next process.
Perfect.
Okay. Next up is Division 005.
Correct. The first change in Division 005 is on page 6, where we have changed a bit of the language regarding principal place of business. It now reads, principal place of business means the office location where the licensee performs public accounting services or
the office location through which a remote licensee provides Putnam County services and designated by a person for purposes of substantial equivalency.
So can you describe that, what that means? So if a person is sitting in Texas and provides services to Oregon, is that what that wording covers?
Yes, if a person is sitting in Texas as a licensee but is working for DeLapp in Lake Oswego, for example, that DeLapp's office would be their principal place of business. And that actually, I mean, not that that has any bearing on what you're doing today, but that actually was the discussion in 2019 with the LRC, and then I believe through to the board, that was the, what I understood as the intent when we, you know, identified office location and so made some changes in that language. It's just clarifying because there's a lot of confusion. We get questions on this all the time, and more and more remote workers.
Okay, so what it's getting at is that it doesn't matter if you're sitting in Texas doing work in Oregon remotely, that you're still Oregon licensee, and the rules still apply to you regardless of where you're physically sitting.
Correct. Because you're doing the work for an Oregon firm. It's that firm that would be your principal place of business, not your kitchen table.
Okay. Do any board members have any other questions on this particular change? Okay, let's go to the next one in 005.
Okay, the next one will be on page 7 regarding revoked. We did change that a bit. A revoked means a license certificate or permit that has been fully canceled. The added language is a revoked license may be restored only if the board determines that there is a good cause to do so.
This change only came about because I believe, Andy, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is the language that's in the statute, so I believe that our rule is more restrictive than the statute.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. Any questions from board members? Jason?
So do we have to have that part in blue in there? Is there a need for that?
It doesn't.
If this end was fully canceled?
It doesn't have to match the statute.
So that's a policy, and I think it just leaves it open for discussion. We don't need to take that in the rule, I think. That's just my opinion.
So, Jason, what you're saying is that at the end of that sentence, end the sentence where it says revoked means a license, certificate, or permit that has been fully canceled, period.
Correct.
Delete the and cannot be reinstated.
Correct. Yes.
Without the additional language. Any other comment?
Policy into it. For procedure into policy.
Okay. That's a good point. Other comments on the change to this definition?
We just had another guest join us, Richard Brewster.
Okay, great. Welcome.
I have a call, Nancy.
Okay, who's speaking?
This is Ron.
Oh, Ron, sorry.
Yeah, I agree with that last statement there, being there, but is it in the right spot? It doesn't seem like it's a definition. It seems like that's an action. That person that Jason was referring to tells what revoke means, and it means, you know, it's fully canceled. But that second spot, is there another place that could be, or is that the best place?
I think it's a really good point. I don't think that we need the sentence, a revoked license may be restored only if the board determines that there is good cause to do so. I don't think that's in the right spot.
Okay. Yeah, I like that, but it just doesn't seem like it fits under that definition.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that taking out the wording that says and cannot be reinstated accomplishes what we need. Yeah. Mr. Brister, if you could put your microphone on mute, please. Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Any other comments by board members on this one? I think that was the major changes. So, Angie, how do we do this? If we're fine with the suggested language in the first change, but want to make a change to the second change, right? So I think we were fine with the wording change in 43, but on 52, we don't want the added sentence, just the removal of the last four words. Is that, can we just make the motion that way?
I mean, increases, you don't have to vote specifically on it, because at this point, they're just going to initiate the rulemaking process. So they're going to go through the whole process, it's going to be the necessary final rule. It's going to go through the whole process. So you can vote, you can provide the direction to staff about how you would like to see the initial proposed rule go out in the rulemaking process, which is what you're doing right now by accepting it. And then when you vote, you initiate the rulemaking process based on the discussion we have.
Okay. And do we need to do each of these individually, or can we do them all at once? We probably need to do them individually based on the content that's up above.
It probably would be a good idea to do it by division.
Yeah, okay. Roel, can you make a motion on zero? Unless there's, is there any other discussion on 005 from the board members? Roel, could you go ahead and make a motion?
We're motioning that we're keeping the last sentence and not using the underlying place, correct?
No, you're just gonna vote to initiate rulemaking on division 5 as discussed.
Okay, I move that we have a discussion on rule 5 as discussed. Move forward.
Okay, is there a second?
I'll second.
Thank you. All in favor, state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
Aye.
Okay, is there one opposed?
Well, I would just leave with my aye.
Okay, all right, so motion has passed. Okay, let's move to division 010.
Okay, so the first page, goes over some ideas that you'll also want to look at the memo that we sent you October 4 regarding the registration requirements. Before we probably get into the fee structure that we're proposing on this first page of Division 10. So I don't know if you want to discuss that first.
Yes. Yeah, and so everyone should have received the handout, the firm registration requirements. And it's a little lengthy, so Kim, can you give us a kind of a rundown?
I am going to give that to Julie, hand it over to her.
I believe it was the February meeting where you discussed this previously, so having all firms register and then possibly having a reduced registration for smaller firms. We also have to do some research and come back. It was either February or May, I can't remember, I'm sorry.
It was February, yeah.
Okay, so we did a little analysis, how many that would affect, I believe. We do have that. I don't think we sent that though. Anyway, just a brief synopsis, sorry. The discussion initially was having registration for all firms, regardless of sole proprietor all the way through, eliminating that confusing loophole and I don't mean loophole in a bad way, but just are you a sole proprietor if you're only one licensee, which it says, or if you're only the named licensee, but you have employees, licensed employees. There's a lot of confusion. There's a lot of gray area in firms. And so this was one proposal that you asked staff to look at. We've done our best to look at language that we thought we'd like in terms of offering a reduction of fees to smaller firms.
So, Julie, one of the questions I have is that in the write-up that you prepared, I talked about a couple examples. One was H&R Block is a retail tax organization. It's not comprised solely of licensees, but it's increasingly made reference to CPAs in their advertising. So in looking at some rule changes in this area, does that mean that H&R Block would have to be registered as a firm?
Well, that's truly up to the board, but I believe one of the things we noted is that businesses like H&R Block are registered with the tax board, so they do have that regulatory oversight. There are other, I'm using firms as a loose word because they look like a firm, they act like a firm, but they are owned by a licensee, so they cannot be a firm under current rules. You've discussed a couple of those in the last year without naming any names, of course. And, you know, that's where this gray area comes in. And it's very difficult. I mean, we see cases go to the BOAC, we see them come to the board. There's a lot of confusion. At the end of the day, it can't be registered under current rules because they're not structured with the proper ownership. But they are out there, they're holding out, just like a firm would with multiple licensees, and it's confusing to the public. So that's where your discussion ended. I'm not sure which direction you want to go, though. So.
Yeah, well, and I think that this is a touchy subject, so we want to make sure we're not doing a knee-jerk response to solve one thing and thereby creating a whole other problem. In the other examples, which is kind of what you just referenced, is that we did discuss a case regarding a firm that employed multiple Oregon licensees who provided services clearly within the definition of the practice of public accountancy at an Oregon location, but the business organization was owned by a non-licensee and was not registered with the tax board. And so the firm, not being structured as public accounting, however, was clearly providing public accounting to the service. And so in this case, there's just a lack of oversight and protection of the public. And so I think that was the element that we were trying to get to when we gave this direction. We also stated in the write-up that in many states, all licensees who work independently are required to register as a firm, which limits uncertainty about registration requirements or compliance related to staffing changes and naming conventions. We're also coming forward with a recommendation for a discount on the current $265 registration fee for sole practitioners in smaller firms, which could be tied to the number of licensees in the organization. This would require both a statutory and rule change. And so in that discussion, and now it takes us back to chapter 10, the research that staff did and from that write-up is being reflected in Rule 10 and the changes that they would have here. So let me clarify, and maybe Angie, this is something that you need to weigh in on. So if we vote yes to go forward with the process for rule changes, there is a public comment period, correct, before we would vote to make these formal and official?
Right. You cannot enter a firm register unless you have statutory change. You can't be someone's with the way the statute is right now. And so that's a whole other process that would need to start a legislative comment.
Okay. Because I definitely on this one would want to receive comment from licensees, and run a really good effort into calling attention to this. Other comments from board members? Okay, so throughout chapter 10, the changes that are proposed from the short letter is what's reflected in here. Is there a motion on the table to proceed with the process?
Before you make that motion, I just want to clarify with Julie and Kim that I don't see in here, like, so what the way that this is being implemented for the initial part of the rulemaking, it's not saying that every single person has to be licensed yet. We're not there yet. Right? We'll just go ahead.
So Angie broke up just a little bit in that last part. I'm sorry.
So I was just saying, is it the way that I look at this, it doesn't really get implemented in the draft proposed rule changes, that it would be that every, you know, solo practitioner needs to register as a firm at this point because we can't do that. Yes, yeah, so I'm to make sure we're not initiating a rulemaking process for something we can't essentially do.
So, Andrew, we talked about breaking this out into two separate Division 10s, but figured it would just be easy enough to incorporate in this discussion that we do understand that some of this could move forward right away in a shorter process, but that anything related to sole practitioners and fees would need to go through the legislative process and require a statute change. So by the board directing us to move forward, we would split off, right? I mean, that part would have to be held to go through the legislative.
So if that's what does the board want to look into, I guess it's sort of a two-part question. I guess the first part is, do you want them to go looking into the statutory change to make all solo practitioners register as a firm?
Okay, so that's the first question. So is there a motion on the table?
I make a motion to look into making sole practitioners register as a firm.
Okay, is there a second, Haley?
Second.
Okay. Those in favor state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, motion is carried. Angie, what's the second?
The second would be to initiate rulemaking based on the proposed as presented to Division 10.
Okay, Jason?
I make a motion to do the revisions to Division 10 board.
Second?
I'll second. Stu.
Thank you, Stu. All in favor state aye.
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 Those opposed? Okay, motion is carried. Okay, the next item up also has a staff recommendation, and it is titled Educational Requirements for Uniform CPA Exam Authorization. So as we look at Chapter 40, I want to first call your attention to the memo from board staff. So at our last board meeting, you recall that we directed staff to go out and do some additional research and bring back a recommendation to the board for the educational requirements. There were two elements to that. One was the inclusion of accounting specific data analytics. And then the second question that required some research is whether or not the board would consider allowing candidates to begin testing prior to the completion of the overall 150 semester hours and 225 quarter hours are completed, as long as they've met the bachelor's requirements and the minimum coursework in core accounting and accounting-related areas. And if so, what limit would the board place on deficient hours? And this, that second question that we're going to discuss today was, I did reach out to Dan Dustin here this last week and had a conversation with him because I wanted to fully have a better understanding of what other states are doing. And so I'll share on that, and if I'm allowed to call on Dan to share us a little bit of information there. But what I'd like to do is first open it up. The proposal is to accept accounting data analytics as part of the study of core accounting. So I'm just going to read this as it's recommended. A minimum of 24 semester hours and 36 quarter hours or the equivalent thereof in the study of core accounting coursework. Core accounting subjects are defined as accounting, auditing, financial reporting, external or internal reporting, financial statement analysis, accounting data analytics, accounting information systems, accounting ethics, or taxation. These hours must be upper division courses.
differentiated from a minimum of 24 semester hours or 36 quarter hours in accounting or related subjects. Related subjects are defined as lower division accounting, business, finance, economics, data analytics, non-accounting, and written and oral communication courses which advance technical competency within the profession. So I'm going to pause there. We've got two questions that we're looking at which are reflected in the rule chapter 40. So
intent.
So discussion on the educational requirements.
So at the bottom of that memo that you just read for, it kind of gives you some discussion points to look at.
Yeah, so the first question is, will the subject categories identified in the proposal meet the needs of students preparing to sit for the Evolve exam in January 2024? Okay, I guess we're now recording. Okay, so again, the question is, and this came up specifically because of the accounting data analytics. And with the CPA evolution and the emphasis and the changes within the CPA exam itself, it was an appropriate time for us to go back and look at and consider the, specifically one of those classes is the data analytics. I personally think that this is a change in the right direction as you look at the students and the skills and abilities that, that we're looking for them to have in preparing for the CPA exam. At least, you know, from looking at all of the information and what some other boards are doing, it feels like adding accounting data analytics specifically is appropriate. What are some other thoughts from board members?
I have a regards to the educational piece of it. So whoever's appropriate to answer this is what is the distinction between data analytics and accounting data analytics? How do you define one versus the other to know that for those that are going to sit for this exam, that in a data analytics course in the business school department, is not going to be sufficient, and what are the distinctions that we need to know about that make them different?
Great question.
I'm happy to take a first pass at that, and perhaps Dan can also piggyback on this. So. I'm sorry, I thought that Deanna was asking for an educator to respond to this. If not, I'm happy to defer my time.
But I think we're having public comment after these rules.
Got it.
Yeah. Okay, so I will call on you, Elizabeth, in a little bit, along with Dan, because I do feel that what other states are doing for implementation of some of these is important, and that the board should pay attention to that. So, Deanna, that's a really good question, and sometimes my concern comes down to, are we getting more focused on form over substance and not paying enough attention to the substance of what a class is offered? So I know that at a base that some consideration has been given to where the course is included, right? So if it's, is it a part of the accounting curriculum starting with ACTG or whatever the abbreviation is, and it's an upper level, and it says, something to the effect of data analytics in accounting or advanced analytic in accounting, that seems very easy, that would be approved. I did this last week also pull up the course syllabus description for Portland State, University of Oregon, Oregon State, I think are the three that I was able to look at, and it felt like the way their accounting data analytics course was written, that it would be, okay, this is very clear, this would count. But that doesn't address your question, is that what if it's an upper level data analytics course, but sponsored by the business department or
just going to make something up. Let's just say that the engineering department offers a high-level data analytics course. And I think that is more specifically getting to your question. So I am going to look to board staff to provide a response to that. What specifically, when we say upper division, what would the board staff be looking at when applicants are submitting their application? What is it that you're looking for to prove that it's an upper division accounting data analytics?
Well, that's, Kim, is it?
All right, I'll jump in.
Yes.
We're still learning, and this is new, so we're still learning, and we have reached out in several instances and spoken with departments when we were unclear. In other areas, obviously not data analytics, because right now that's a lower division course, a lower related course. We look at the course descriptions. We have actually the candidates email us the link to the course description for their school when we can't find it, so that we're looking at that specific course. What we do see coming through is we're looking at these data analytics courses, as a lot of them are like CIS courses, from the computer information systems track rather than an accounting track. I don't know how that relates exactly yet. Most of the ones that we've seen coming through from U of O, Oregon State, Portland State, they actually do include accounting information in there. So they discuss, even in the course description, how it relates to accounting, but not all courses do. Some of the other schools that we're seeing, you know, it's very generic. It's more of a computer analysis, but not accounting focus.
Okay, so what I'm hearing you say is that if there was a course description, or a course presented to the board that was upper division data analytics, and it included somewhere in the description, maybe not necessarily in the title of the class, but in the description and the content of the class, that it was, directed at accountants, then that would be accepted. Is that what I'm hearing?
Correct. That's how I believe would happen. Yes.
Okay, because there's only two components here. And let me ask it this way. I'm looking at the board members now. Is there agreement that accounting data analytics should be considered a core class? And that's the question that we're going to vote on. The other piece of it, and I guess underneath that, is, so how do we implement this? I want to make sure that it's implemented in a way that is, you know, fair, consistent, transparent, and where we're being accountable to the public and being fair to the students and the courses that they are taking. If they're, you know, they don't want to go 4 years through a course to find out, you know, through their program to find out that there's a course that all of a sudden is not going to be counted because it's not titled correctly. And so that substance of the course is important. And, you know, we've got, you know, four main universities in Oregon. And I do think that within our Oregon schools, right, that we need to take a concerted effort when it comes to the data analytics and make sure that we've communicated clearly to the universities which courses would be considered the upper division core accounting and which ones would not be considered core accounting, right? So I guess if it's not on the list of what would be considered core accounting, that it wouldn't qualify. But I think that we need to do that measure. This has been a sticky area and very confusing to so many candidates. I do have another question in looking at this, is that there have been some students who submitted to the board and got rejected because their data analytics ended up then going into the just related area instead of being considered a core. Are we going to go back and reconsider those applicants and reevaluate their application? Have we given consideration to that?
We have not, staff-wise, we haven't considered that. The proposal and the rules on page 6 of Division 10, it's 24 hours equivalent study of core accounting course where core accounting subjects are defined as accounting, auditing, financial reporting, external or internal reporting, financial statement analysis, accounting data analytics, accounting information systems, accounting ethics checks, and these hours will be upper division.
And I think that the reading of that, Kim, is good. What the board staff did there was good, the way it's been written. It's just a matter of the implementation that I just want to make sure that we all have the same understanding of what it means to implement this particular this particular piece. So there's those two things.
Okay. So because our role right now is data analytics is considered related, I don't know that we would want to go back and change that, because they can still use that and it's still good information for them to have. It still goes through, you know, their 150, towards their related subjects, all of that, and so there's that piece. We also have to go through a rule revision to accept these changes to the proposed rules. We're hoping, and I think there's something in your agenda regarding timelines, we're hoping to get these all approved and through the Secretary of State and all of that by December 31st. So beginning January of next year, those data analytic courses would then go into the core accounting, should they be a core accounting data analytic course. Does that make sense?
I think so. So Angie, I have a question for you. If we, you know, go forward with accepting data analytics as a core course, and I'm understanding, you know, what Kim is describing, said it's got to go through all the rule making and all of that, and be formally changed. But does that mean that the board cannot, at this time, knowing that we're going forward with that, does that mean that the board could not go ahead now and approve the upper division data analytics, accounting data analytics, as a core course?
Well, we could do a number, so you could do a temporary rule effective upon filing, and then you get a temporary rule, and then you would do the permanent rule simultaneously, so that then that would go into effect in December when Kim said, so there's the option of doing that. We're trying to do rules is a little bit more of a tricky subject. So I'm not sure if we want to necessarily go down that road, but there is the option of doing the temporary rules that it would happen going forward as soon as it's filed.
Okay, good. Okay, so I guess the first question for us, for the board to vote on is, as written, the recommendation by staff to
give the, before you guys vote, do you guys want to get the information from, is this from everyone else? Is that going to happen? I thought that the idea was that was going to happen first before we vote it off.
Yeah, we just hold the vision 10 to go through, so yeah.
Oh, okay. But I guess I just, right now, I just want to hear from board staff on, and so I'm understanding we're not going to take a vote right now, but is there any other concerns with accepting data analytics as a core course?
No, I'm not. That's what we're recommending, as long as it's the core accounting data analytics piece.
Okay. And then the other piece of this, the other part of the discussion, was should the board consider allowing candidates to sit, to begin testing prior to completion of the overall 150 semester and 225 quarter hours are being completed, as long as they've met the bachelor's requirements and the minimum coursework in core accounting and accounting related areas. And if so, what limit would the board place on deficient hours? And with that, I talked with Dan earlier this week, and I know I'm going a little bit accepting public comment, but because Dan has been kind enough to give us some of his time this morning, I did want to just allow Dan, if he could just make a couple comments on what other states are doing. He provided me a listing, which I just didn't get the opportunity to send out to folks. But Dan, could you just go ahead and provide us a synopsis of what other states are doing in this area?
Sure. So with respect to the opportunity for kids to sit for the exam,
really jurisdictions fall into three buckets, if you will. One is that they require 150 hours to sit for the exam, and that's what Oregon has right now. And there are, right now, six jurisdictions on our list that require 150 hours. One is Oregon, another is Ohio. Ohio just recently went through a statutory change that will change them from 150 hour requirement in the near term. I believe it's beginning of next year, so you'll be down to five. There's another bucket where jurisdictions require individuals to be within a certain period of time of having their 150 hours in order to sit for the exam. And that varies among jurisdictions. It could be anywhere from 60 days to 6 months or more. And if you will, that's similar to what we used to do under the paper and pencil exam, where because the exam was given in May, early May, and a lot of students didn't graduate until late May, we allowed them to sit with knowing that they would potentially have their final transcript later in May. And some boards have adopted that as well. And then the third bucket is really allowing individuals to sit with some level of accounting and business coursework with 120 hours of education. So it's a bit broader than saying within a certain period of time of reaching 150 hours.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Dan. I just wanted everybody to have the opportunity to hear what some other states are doing in this area. And in hearing that, you know, Oregon's on the short list of being firm on that 150 hours. So when you look at that, there's the opportunity here to say, okay, well, you've got the bachelor's degree, you've met all of the required accounting courses, but you don't yet have the 150 hours, right? And so to get you to the 150 hours, maybe you're going to go take a communications class or whatever, basket weaving, but it's not a core curriculum and not a core course that you need to go sit for the CPA exam. Are we willing to open that door? And Dan described it really well. You know, the core requirements have been met. If we allow that, then what period of time would we want the availability window to be that say, okay, you've met the bachelor's degree, you've met all of your accounting requirements, we're going to let you sit for the exam, but you now have, what, 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, 1 year to finish off your 150 credits. Of course, you cannot be fully licensed until you have completed the 150 hours, you know, those types of things. So I want to open up the discussion now to the board members for comment on that. And Sherry, I do see that you have a question. I will circle back around to you in just a bit here. I want to hear from the board members.
Well, this is Stu. I'm very much in favor of this. I was around when they implemented it going the other way. I mean, you had to have the 150 hours first. And I think it did a lot of damage to our profession by delaying people able to get jobs when other people were already going for other areas, and delayed them up to a year of being able to get employment as a CPA. Now, I mean, working towards a CPA, not now. I think this is a good move in the right direction for the future of our profession.
Stu, what would you think the window would be? You know, so if you're going to sit for the exam, you've met all the bachelor's, you've met the accounting requirements, the required courses, and now you just need those final courses to get you to 150. Do you think a 3 month, 6 month, 9 month, 1 year period of time?
I'd say 1 year.
Okay.
Up to 1 year, but no more.
Up to 1 year and no more. Okay, great. Thank you, Stuart. Any other board members? Deanna?
Yeah, so I appreciate the comment because it changed my position. I'm pretty much a hard and fast rule stickler. Like 150, you gotta have 150, no. But I'm willing, you know, I've moved off that position to the more of a period of time because it doesn't you're required to have your core accounting courses done. I would not be open to having that one changed. But with the accounting, it was my understanding, is the accounting exam now is pretty much wide open in terms of when you can start to take your exam. So I'd be less apt to have the time go longer than, and I don't have the exact number, but I'll just say 90 days, I'm going to pull it out of the air. I don't have any rhyme or reason, that's just a feel-good number for me. Because that's about how long it takes to finish a class. It's going to take you 3 months. you know, 90 days to get through a course. But, you know, you're not going to, it's not, the exam's not like it was before. It's not only offered twice a year. You know, it's wide open. So that's my thought in that respect.
Yeah, so if you look at somebody who has, what, 120 credits because they've got the bachelor's degree and all the other requirements, and they need 150, so they're lacking 30. So it seems like that would be one or two quarters to, you know, so maybe a year is too much, but maybe 90 days is not enough, right? Maybe, you know, maybe somewhere in between. I don't know. I'd like to hear some other feedback. Joe?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with looking at a change. I would probably hear more towards like 6 months or 9 months.
Great, thank you, Joe. Bailey?
I mean, I think that it gets a little bit tricky depending on what courses people want to take and what they're trying to accomplish with their additional courses, if they're, you know, getting their additional classes through their minor or something along the lines. There could be some issues with sequencing and just the order of when the class is offered, which is why it puts me more in the camp of a year, because you have that full, you know, that full year to try to hit whichever, you know, semester or term window that you need to hit to get that course that you're looking for, versus just settling for something else because you couldn't get what you wanted.
Great, thank you, Haley. Roll?
Yeah, I really thought of a good point I hadn't thought about is the fact, because I remember going to school, that those courses I had to wait for to finish my degree, and it extended the time. And so I think that might be an issue for some individuals. In the case they're trying to complete a minor, like you said, it might be more than 3 to 6 months before they can even take that course. So are we cheating them by making them say, you got to have it done in 3 months? Just go take a PE class and you're done, but they don't get anything out of it. And I think the substance of this is to make sure they're as rounded as they want to be or can be coming out of education. So I think a good extended period of time, maybe not more than a year, would be good.
Okay, great. Thank you, Will. Jason?
So we're really not entertaining lowering the credit limit to like the 120 or the 130. Okay.
No.
Those are all good arguments. I really have an opinion on the timeline and everything, but I think there could be an extended timeline, like closer to a year, like Stuart was saying.
Okay. Great. Thank you. From the board members, did I call on all the board members? Did everyone get to say? Anybody have any follow-up comments now that they've heard comments from other board members? Okay. So, Nancy, can I ask a question? This is Julie.
Yes.
So, just from an implementation standpoint, if we're looking at a year, it's very likely that somebody will have passed all sections of the exam. The moment we let them test, they can apply for all four sections. They can have all four passed. What do we do if they don't complete it within a year? I guess if we're looking at an extended period of time like that, which I mean I have no problem with whatsoever, are we then really looking at it just has to be completed before they can apply for licensure? Because I don't know how we go back a year later and say, well, you passed all four sections, but now we're taking it back because you didn't turn in your, you know, final transcript.
So what is
the rule right now is that when you've passed a section, you have to get the other sections passed with, what's the horizon there?
Within 18 months.
Okay. And so let's play it out. So today, I've earned my bachelor's degree with all my accounting credits, and the Board of Accountancy is going to let me sit for the exam. So I take the first exam on November 1st, and I pass one exam every 3 months. Okay, so within 1 year I've passed the entire CPA exam. And is it that, and now the year's gone by but I haven't finished my coursework. Okay, so now we're looking at at what point does that first exam that they've passed fall off? I guess is what the question is, or would it fall off? And gosh, I don't know.
Once they've passed the fourth section, then no, I mean, those scores are all locked in. They don't expire. Well, in Oregon, they wouldn't expire for 8 years.
Okay.
But if they had...
Okay, because once they've all passed, so they're all, they've all passed, right? Okay.
And we actually have had candidates in the past who, I mean, that initial exam application has all four sections included, and they'll take one a week or one every other week and pass them all within a, just a very short period of time, which is fabulous. I mean, they, you know, they're prepared.
Yeah. That's a good question. Thoughts from the board?
This is Jason. So we're saying that they have to have their bachelor's and they have to have the core accounting classes. Is that correct? Am I understanding that?
Mm-hmm. They have to have that.
Okay. So what other PE classes are going to make them a better accountant? Why wouldn't we give them, if they don't get the additional credits for 8 years, they just never get their license and the exam is no longer valid. But a year or 2 years, if they're not even credit, they don't get their experience. So I don't see the year being a hard, fast thing. I think we could set a limit and then allow for exceptions. Like, if there was COVID, we might extend it up for another 6 months after a year. I don't know.
Yeah, it's a good point. Feels like there's always an exception. Okay, other thoughts?
Well, this is Stu again, and going back to the origin of 150 hours, the whole idea was to sort of take these accountants who were pretty narrow-minded and broaden their horizons. And I know I took scuba diving, and I got 6 or 4 hours of science credit. But why was it scuba diving worth the time? It was because I was in the shipbuilding business. I was an accountant for a major shipbuilder in the city of Portland. So it was a goofy class, I mean, from learning anything other than saving your life. The whole idea was to make me more well-rounded. And I think that, you know, whatever course you take, be it cooking, basket weaving, scuba diving, or some other goofy course, it's still absurd, it's still achieving its goal that was set out 15 years ago, was to round out some of these square accountants.
Good point. Thanks, Stu. Other thoughts by the board?
Good question. I'm sorry. So you guys are, are you guys basically saying you want to try and move forward with a lot of people for the exam before they graduate?
Well, so Angie, it's after they've completed all the requirements for the bachelor's degree, and they've completed all of the accounting curriculum as required, as you know, the core accounting coursework and then the related subject coursework. They've completed all of that, but have not yet obtained the 150 hours. So then the question before the board is would we allow them to start sitting for the exam once they've met the bachelor's and the core accounting and the accounting related, they just have that gap between 120 hours and 150 hours that we have right now. So by letting them go ahead and start on that, we would give them, just picking a time right now, a year to finish out that coursework to get to their 150 hours.
Okay. And we have to change the statute. The statute says 150 hours before you can sit for the exam.
Okay. So then what we're saying is then we would want to make a statute change from the hardcore 150 hours to the minimum bachelor's for accounting related, and have 1 year within which to obtain the additional credits needed to get to 150. That's what we're talking about. So is generally from the board members, are you guys comfortable with that? You could just kind of give me a thumbs up here. Okay, so I don't see any thumbs down. So then that takes us back to the rule 10.
Okay, Nancy?
Yes.
Can a person even get a bachelor's degree without, in accounting, without completing the 150 hours? Can we hear from an educator on how that works?
Yes, we can. Elizabeth?
Jason, can you repeat that, please? Can they get an accounting degree without getting 150? Is that your question?
Well, the question,
yeah.
Kind of, so if you're an accounting student today with only you're getting a bachelor's degree in accounting, would that degree completely fulfill the fulfills the bachelor requirements? But is it reasonable to say that fulfills the required core accounting coursework and the related subjects?
It does at all the Oregon public universities, the three major public universities. I'm unfamiliar with the other schools. It's a school-by-school decision as to what they approve as their curriculum. The majority, vast majority of schools would, however, in an accounting curriculum, design that degree requirement to map into an appropriate jurisdiction's CPA exam requirements. But since those vary by state, most schools just make sure that it maps into their states. So somebody coming from out of state may not meet our requirements.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
Elizabeth, are you saying that right now our schools are mapped to 150 hours?
No, they're mapped to 120 hours. 120 is a bachelor's degree, but there's two parts to this. There's the actual course requirements to sit for the exam and the number of corresponding credits for that, and then there's the degree requirements. And accounting bachelor's degrees are 120 credits, or the quarter hour equivalent. So there's never a bachelor's degree that I'm aware of that would get mapped to 150 hours. That's a fifth year.
Mm-hmm. And in that fifth year, you know, I hear what everyone's saying is that, well, they can just go to basket weaving and PE and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Okay, you know, it's up to each individual person how they use that fifth year. You know, they can make it count more, you know, maybe they work on organizational effectiveness or communication. And it's all intended, as Stu said earlier, is let's round out the candidates a little bit more. It's up to them how they use that time and how they invest in themselves. I don't think we can get down into that kind of detail and start dictating that. I don't think that would be right. So it's, so thank you, Elizabeth, for those comments and answering that question. Is there any other comments by the board right now before I refer us back to section 10? Okay, so in section 10, and I know that we already gave the approval to go forward on that, but I just want to point out that those changes that we just discussed are stated in your track changes in chapter 10. And so I guess the only thing I'd put back, Kimberly and Julie, is that based on our discussion, there may need to be some additional changes based on the board's discussion just now. Do you feel that you have enough direction for that?
I certainly no, I don't know where we landed as far as, are you tied to a year? Is that where everybody's feeling comfortable? Or is it just prior to licensure? I don't feel like I have a clear picture of where you're at right now.
Okay, so I think that after hearing all the comments, we were looking at a year. Taking into consideration that, like Ralph said, there might be some courses that don't, you know, like maybe they only come up once a year. And so they may have to wait a whole rotation, you know, they might have to wait 6 months. So I think, a year is more than reasonable, because when you look at the difference between 120 credits and 150 credits, that's 30, that's two quarters or however it works in the university. So saying 1 year is reasonable to take into account the timing of certain classes. Does anybody feel differently than the 1 year? And then I guess, you know, Julie, your other question was, okay, so what happens if, you know, the 1 year comes and goes and they didn't get their additional credits? You know, I mean, they, you know, they don't get licensed. I mean, I think we need to have, we have to have a timeline in there, otherwise it could just go on for forever. And so if we have the scenario where the individual did not complete their coursework within the required time, I think that we need to consider a proposal from board staff on what we would do there. I would not want to take away their entire, you know, passing of the exam.
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
This is Stu. Can we move them, if that's the case, and they don't complete that in a year, move them to an inactive status? And they can be due through the inactive process.
Well, they wouldn't become licensed if they hadn't come, if they hadn't completed the required hours.
Well, but you've given them a license with at the 120 hour.
No, we don't have the option to begin testing.
A provisional license? Okay, whatever.
No, it's just permission to start sitting for the exam. That's all that it is.
Right, 120. But then you've got your degree.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If they don't complete everything within the years, but yet they're still within the 18 months of the exam, can you make them inactive? Is all I'm, you know, is there a status that you can put them to that allows them to get back in if they finish up what they're supposed to do?
Like an inactive testing status?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it's just a thought. I mean, I don't have any answers. I'm just trying to figure out a way to bridge that area that you're going to run into trouble with people over more than a year.
This may create some issue for Kim and Angie, so I'm sorry, but like, if we're looking at a year, I'm just trying to brainstorm how we can implement this, right? Because to have a rule that we can't do anything about, it, you know, it creates more issue. But so if we had something in there about a year, could we potentially limit and say you can begin testing, but you can take no more than two sections of the exam before, or three sections, so they wouldn't be able to take the final section without having the full 150 hours, if that's where we're at. I don't know what that rule would look like. I haven't had a chance to think about it, but.
Well, could we lessen the complication? And 18 months from the beginning of when you start testing to the last time you take a test. So can we do the same thing for the educational? Once you start your testing, you have 18 months to get your final credit. And that matches up with how long they have to pass the test, too.
But it doesn't take that long for most people, or for a lot of people, to pass the test. Or,
Well, generally, if 18 months goes by, right? So there's kind of a couple components. You took the first exam, and now, you know, if you don't pass all four within that 18 months, and you start losing the first one, and it kind of rolls, right? So that's an 18 month period of time. If you do pass all four sections, you get 150 hours, but you fail to get licensed within eight years?
Yes.
And it goes away. So I think what we're looking at is kind of another application of that. And there's a couple different ways we can go. You mentioned earlier, you know, the idea of saying, well, if you've got your bachelor's and at the minimum accounting, then you can take, you know, whatever, no more than three of the exams prior to having the 150 hours, or, you know, we can say, well, as soon as that clock starts ticking, it's 18 months. You know, you've got 18 months to pass the exam, you've got 18 months to finish off your core 150 hours, otherwise you start over, you know, on that process, on the exams, they would drop off.
And the class would drop off too, or would they stay?
Well, the classes would stay because that's part of their transcript. But the courses would drop off. The exams that they passed would start dropping off.
Right. So this would make everything consistent. You don't have to be looking at one set of rules.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you need two requirements. You've got to pass four parts of the exam. You have to have your 150 hours, and they can be at the same date.
I have a question, and it's going back to the why are we doing this standpoint of, you know, Julie brought up at one point, like, you can't get your license until you have your 150, 225, anyway. And so if somebody wants to knock themselves out, take the exam while they're in their master's program or whatever, okay, good for them, yay. but they're not going to get licensed until they get their credits. So I guess I don't know what the benefit is to someone for being like, well, I passed the CPA exam. Like, good on you. Go get your license. They have to get that coursework. So are we overcomplicating things by trying to add this extra like step in there? And can we just shed that and go, okay, once you have your 120 in your, well, your 120, I don't think you need your bachelor's. Once you have your 120, you can start taking the exam. You pass the exam, you have 8 years to get your license. That includes your coursework and your experience.
Yeah, I like that idea. That does. It makes it much easier.
Just to cover the European statute, you have to have 150 at your bachelor's.
So we have to change statute for this part as well.
Well, we're already changing it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, the statutory process change, you know, they
yes.
Well, the whole idea, I think, was to let them start on the exam before they get to the 150 hours.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's our whole discussion is centered. Mm-hmm. I don't care how we attach it together, but as long as we give them a chance to get a head start, we don't lose so many people to sales and intel. You know, they're not working for more money. In a much less stressful job, so.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to other states.
So. We're trying to keep them here if we can.
Yeah. Okay, so
we do get applications like this where candidates transferring scores from other states that have also, they're under that structure of bachelor's degree meeting these minimum core requirements but don't have the 150, so it wouldn't be different than what we require then. That they demonstrate at that point that they've met the 150 as well.
Mm-hmm. So, Julie, do you feel like you have enough direction now?
I do. What about you, Kim? Are you feeling good?
I do understand the direction. I just now need to learn how to do the statutory changes.
Okay. Okay, so on our voting matrix, we'd already discussed Section 10, but it sounds like there might be a few changes coming forward on that one.
Yeah, quite a bit more on
Yeah. Okay, so then, sorry, I feel like I lost my place. So I think that as far as the educational, and I, like I said earlier, I know that public comment was slated for after this, but then to keep from jumping around from topics, I'd like to go ahead and accept the public comment now on this particular subject only. And so, Sherry, I know you've had your hand up for a while, so I'm going to call on you.
Thank you. Thank you kindly. My comment really is around, you have an expert with Dan Dustin in the room. He mentioned three buckets, and he mentioned six jurisdictions. I just heard yesterday about Ohio, so I understand that will move to five. The other two jurisdictions, could Dan share, if he has that data available, how many states are within those jurisdictions? You know, because my understanding, the number I heard yesterday from 120 to 6 was very significant for the country. So I'd like more accuracy on that from the source rather than hearsay. Secondarily, I guess my overarching comment too is just, you know, to be able to follow some continuity across the country. So as, you know, as folks are moving about, folks are much more mobile than they used to be. So just to, you know, that caution of making sure that we don't put ourselves into a corner in Oregon where we end up having difficulty. I mean, that would be my overarching request from the board from, you know, what direction you go. So, and I mean that all from a very well-intentioned perspective. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Sherry. Further, Elizabeth, did you have any additional comments?
On the 150-120, no.
Okay. And Dan, I just want to open it up if you wanted to make any additional comments here after having heard our discussion from the board members.
Sure. Actually, I do have that other data, and there are, I believe, 12 jurisdictions. I'm reading a chart and trying to count quickly, but there's 12 jurisdictions that are following the model that you were suggesting or you're discussing about passing the exam within a certain time period. So if you have the 5 plus the 12, subtract those two numbers from 55, and you'll get the number who basically say you need 120 hours plus some amount of accounting coursework to take the exam.
Great. Thank you, Dan.
I'm sorry. Just one other thing. It's important, I think, to make sure you at least have some level of accounting and business content as part of that requirement, because otherwise, if you just say 120 hours to sit for the exam, it could be then anybody with a liberal arts degree or any other type of degree applying to sit for the exam, and we certainly don't want that. You want to make sure that they're interested in becoming a CPA.
Yeah, agreed. And it would be with the understanding that they have met all of the core accounting and accounting-related courses. So thank you. Thank you, Dan. And thank you for spending time with us today. I appreciate you taking this time on your busy schedule. So, great. Okay, so I think we were down then to Division 40.
We're still in Division 10.
We're still in Division 10. Okay. And what do we need to do on Division 10?
Okay, so page 4 of Division 10, it's nothing too exciting. We got rid of testing windows because we don't do testing windows now. They can be test whenever they want to. So nothing big there. The next piece is on page 6, where I've already read what we are defining as the core accounting courses and the related subjects. One thing that we did add for your consideration is CLEP or AP exam credits, and limiting those to 8 semester or 12 quarter hours.
And what are those?
I can't remember what it's, what's it stand for? Give me a second. Julie, what's CLEP?
Yeah, the AP exams course, for example, if you're in high school and you take a course that is designated for AP credits, you can get college credit for your high school course. Those would then go, you could apply to have those on your college transcript. Generally, we see in the range of 8 to 12, depending on, quarter or semester, but occasionally, we'll see a transcript with, some unreal number that, so it's just for your consideration. I mean, I think the last one we saw had like 37 credits that were just applied through CLEP and AP. So it's a little
bit. Just limiting it. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, not getting rid of it. Just. Are you ready to move on?
Or yes.
Okay. There's a little change about testing. It just says a candidate may schedule testing through an approved administration testing administrative center. It's just a weird clarification that doesn't. It means something to us, but it's just another way to.
And Kim, can we find out? Does this meet Angie's concerns? Angie, does this meet your concerns about testing center locations versus online testing?
Page 7.
Read the statute before the other statute. I mean, I guess we're getting the intent behind it, but I mean, they're still calling it a center. So, that is a concern, so we might want to tweak that a little bit. But if we have the general idea,
An approved administration center in Oregon or in any other jurisdiction?
Okay,
and then it says cannabis must comply with procedures of the center. So you don't make sure. Okay, the next one is on page 8. Just another
clarification, a request for extension for a valid NTS must be submitted in writing prior to the expiration of the NTS or as soon as reasonably able. We have had some people during this past couple of years that were not able to ask for an extension because they were either sick or several different reasons. So instead of not allowing that, we're letting them have a reasonable time. And I guess another piece is on this is that if your credits have expired or your NTS has expired, you need to let us know as soon as you can, because we have had some candidates who request an extension 6 months down the road when they should have done it 6 months prior. So this is kind of where we're at with that one.
Okay, Jason?
This is what we want to do. Should I just send this to Kim? I have a lot of little items for Division 10. I don't know if it's the proper place to do that or not.
That's a good question. Angie?
So if they want to be a part of this rulemaking process, then yes, or if you want them to come and separate it.
So can either come either way?
Yeah,
Jason, you can just go ahead and send it to board and staff. Unless there's something really substantive that should be discussed by the board members.
It would still have to come back to initiate rulemaking if it's imminent. It might be a change.
Mm-hmm. The only thing I have that I guess would be substantive is this last one for the, I think we should have a timeline, not as soon as reasonably able, because we have to then define that in the board later on and decide, well, this one was 33 days, should we allow it? This one was 60 days, should we allow it? I think we should give some kind of timeline.
Right, I'm writing that down, Jason. Thank you.
I think good comment. Okay, next.
Next is page 9. Regarding credit exam sections, little d, the time limitations for a candidate to complete all sections of the exam may be extended by the board, again, for a reasonable period of time. So that kind of goes back with Jason, so I'm going to make a note there. On a case-by-case basis, due to illness, accident, or other circumstances, including testing site closures. We didn't have that in our rules before, but of course, as you know, we've had a lot of closing of testing centers due to COVID, and shall be extended during the time a candidate is in active military service. A written request must be received to the board prior to expiration of the credit or within 3 months of the qualifying event, including documentation supporting the request for extension.
I think it's a really good example of how you remove that as reasonably soon after as possible and given it some more parameters. I think that's very helpful.
Okay. Great. Let's see. What's next? Next change is on page 12. It is regarding experience. And what we did there was on Big C, instead of saying experience must include, experience may include. So that gives us a little bit more wiggle room there. And then we added performing accounting analytics as an experience piece. So nothing major there. Next change is on page 18, and this is regarding reciprocity. We have a memo that you should each have regarding the reciprocity changes. What's on page 18 says, applicants who were granted an initial license in another jurisdiction within 6 months prior to the date an application for reciprocity is received in the board office must submit a competency narrative in accordance with OAR 801-10-0073 with the application materials. What we are seeing is
candidates, or I'm sorry, applicants that are from Oregon and working in Oregon go to another state, get a license, and then reciprocity back within a very, very short period. And the reason why they do that is because they don't want to write the narrative to show that their experience has been supervised and substantive.
So this gets the narrative, so this closes that loophole and will require the narrative anyway.
That's correct.
Okay?
But only for the first 6 months, I don't understand. If I apply in 7 months, I don't.
Well, if you were licensed in another jurisdiction and you applied 7 months later, you'd be violating a different board rule. So one way or the other, I mean, if your goal is to not write the narrative and you go to another state, then you'd be working in Oregon with an out-of-state license anyway, which is a violation. Is that clear? I mean, am I being clear? I feel like my words are not.
No, yeah, that was clear. So the six months has a reason.
Right, because by rule they have 60 days to apply for reciprocity with an out-of-state license. And then they have 3 months to complete that application by rule. So that's 5 months. So if we go 6 months that they have to do the narrative, then it's just a way to ensure that they've met the competencies, you know, rather than check boxes. So.
You get there?
Yes.
Okay. Next page, there's a slight change with the temporary license for armed forces. We just added the date the person's authorization issued by another jurisdiction rather than state, and then we added that permit fees are not prorated. And that's just for the military, because it's a temporary permit. Next we have on page 22, resigning licenses that are not subject of pending complaints or void investigations. What we're doing here is, sorry, I heard good today. Certified public accountant or public accountant may resign or surrender a license issued under our statutes by submitting a written resignation. And what we did is, what we have been doing is, if a CPA just wants to resign because he just wants to resign, he doesn't want to lapse, he doesn't want to retire, he just wants to resign his license, we in the past have asked them for their wall certificate, which is for some people a very, very important piece of paper that they like to hang on their wall. And so, because there's no reason not to, we are just scratching that they have to provide the original certificate back to the board so they can keep that. We're also doing that for people who retire, I believe. So we keep going on page 22. We have written, let's see what I said. The licensee is required to return the CPA wall certificate and wall license card to the board as specified in the final order, and that's for licensees who are subject to complaints or a void investigation. If we then tell them if they resign on the revocation, that they would need to give us their certificate and their permit card. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I'm just curious, Kimberly, when we're in those situations, how many of them actually really return the wall certificate?
The ones that are under investigation or in lieu of? Well, we don't revoke a lot, so, but most of them do. In fact, yeah. I remember the last time we didn't, but that, you know, because there's so few and far between.
Okay.
Okay. Next page is 23, and
this is kind of under the same vein, requirements upon resignation. Upon voluntary resignation, a former licensee is required to, and we again said you don't have to resign, or you don't have to surrender your certificate, so they get to keep their MOL certificate. And we say upon resignation in lieu of revocation, which we were just talking about, they do have to surrender their certificate, their permit card, take all reasonable steps to avoid foreseeable harm to any client, including but not limited to providing written notice of resignation under this section to all clients and inform all clients of where client records and work papers will be stored and of the client's right to secure copies of all such records and work papers at no cost to the client. We also added that they must maintain client records as stated in OAR 801-30-0030 for a period of at least 7 years and notify clients of the location of their records for collection or return of such records to the client, and continue to comply with the requirements of OAR Chapter 801 Division 30 pertaining to confidential information and client records. Unless otherwise required by the board, a resigning licensee at a registered firm is required to give written notice to all of those firm clients for which the resigning licensee was the sole or primary CPA on an engagement leader, or the client relationship manager. So that's the new language proposed.
Okay, keep going. If a board member has a concern, please just chime right in. Okay.
Page 25, under number 4, inactive licensees use of the CPA designation. We added an inactive Oregon licensee who works in private industry in Oregon and holds an active license in another jurisdiction shall not use the CPA or PA designation in Oregon unless the other jurisdiction's name and license number are used in conjunction with the designation, such as CPA Oregon Kim Fast number 1234, and is listed in the same font size. So we do that with CPA inactives and CPA retired. So we're just asking them to say if they have a license that is outside of Oregon, and my dog's gonna bark, hang on. So you would have to say Kimberly Fast Oregon CPA or Kimberly Fast Idaho CPA, so that they identify as having another license. Okay, next is page 26, retired license. Again, same thing. Retired Oregon licensee who holds, and this is just the one I was just doing, so we don't need to go to that. Lapsed licensee, page 27. We added a lapsed Oregon licensee who holds a lapsed license in another jurisdiction. Again, CPA lapsed state name and name font size. So on page 28, we are looking at reinstatements. We have added credit for programs in non-technical subjects is limited to 8 hours, and that is for reinstatement from lapsed status to inactive status, which is our rules anyway. It's just clarifying. And we took out a date that no longer is valid. Lapsed more than 6 years or 3 renewals, a licensee that has lapsed for more than 3 consecutive renewal periods will expire. So that was just a clarification piece. No biggie there either. We are now at application requirements for firms. I'm on page 35. We added a little b under H, little b, registration renewals that are postmarked by the U.S. Postal Service or other delivery service electronically stamped or submitted through an online process managed by the board after December 31st and no later than January 31st must include a late fee. That's just clarification of our new IT system, all that good stuff. I just want to know that we have two guests joining the meeting right now.
Thank you.
Okay. I'm on page 36. This is just a clarifying piece. A firm registration that is terminated for more than three consecutive renewal periods will expire. As consistent with what we do with our CPAs, if they have been last for 6 years and they expire, so we just made that for the firms as well. Next page is 37. We talk about plural firm names. We added the language, the use of a plural title, including words like and associates, is not misleading if, in addition to the names of persons included in the firm name, the firm has at least two additional partners, shareholders, owners, or members, or employs at least two additional staff persons who work a minimum of 20 hours a week, who are licensed to practice public accountancy under statute, and whose permit is not revoked, suspended, last retired, or inactive. You get the firm?
Okay. I just have a question.
Yeah.
On page one, I'm going to start over again. Is that a correct statement? Correct statement under large A? Three-quarters of the way down the page, it says, well, the fee or the sole practitioner's fee will be reduced by $215.
This goes back to our conversation on the firm registration requirements, Stuart.
It's a dollar amount. Are we putting ourselves so low we're going to go in the deficit situation? Because the renewal is $255, and you take off $215, only leaves $40 in my book.
Well, the renewal for firms is $265, so it would leave $50, which is the renewal fee for inactive and retired.
Okay, well, look, up above it says the same thing under registration of sole practitioner shall be reduced by $250. I just want to make sure that was correct. It just seemed like a big reduction.
So this would actually be a new income, Stu, because sole practitioners were not previously required. We're talking about having them register as a firm, and we're trying to lighten the load by having a minimal sole practitioner firm fee put in place.
I was just making sure we're not missing the boat. We've taken that into account in our projected income for the future.
And just clarify that amount is in the statute. So.
Yes, we right. Exactly know that.
All of the firm changes would require statute change, right, Angie? We're.
Okay, as long as we're not shooting ourselves in the foot, then okay.
I would recommend just for this, I think most boards don't have the amount in statute, they just say,
I suspect. Okay. Right, mostly times we don't have, but that was a negotiation that we had with the society, I believe, Sherry, if you remember when we were, when we raised our fees a few years ago, that was one piece that they, I think, was a negotiating piece to have some dollar amount for our licensees and our firms.
The society advanced the fee bill for the Board of Accountancy, and when the society advanced that fee bill through legislative process, which became statute, we did place a fee in there. That way we could be able to discuss it if we were coming back and asked to advance a fee bill again. And it was very unique across the country. Folks were very surprised when they had learned that we had advanced the fee bill on behalf of the Board of Accountancy's budget. So that was the background.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kimberly.
Yeah, thank you.
But you're right, Angie, that now with that fee in there, we don't have an option to reduce it, right, without changing the statute. Mm-hmm.
I guess it's comes up.
Okay.
Okay, and so Kim, Julie, you've heard some comment from board members about taking out the "or as soon as possible" language and being more specific.
Okay. The reasonable amount of time language, yes.
Okay, and then there may have been some other minor edits that Jason was going to forward to you as well. Other comments by board members? Any concerns? Any areas you want to?
Jason, did you have more changes other than that?
Yeah, there is wordsmithing though. It's like initial in front of initial from registration and not putting initial in front of municipal auditor.
Okay, those are great to have. Thank you for that.
My understanding for Angie though is if we receive those after the board meeting, then all of this would have to come back to the board for.
And voting to have this go forward in the process, it's still going to receive public comment and go through additional reviews before anything is final and set in stone, correct?
Yes. Yeah. And then one question, we still haven't gotten the comment from the, I think we're there, other people that wanted to give comments from the chief.
We still have Division 40 to go through. It's not very much. And then once, if there's no other changes that you would like to make during this process, like we've said before, we'll gather up more information. We'll take the comments that you've made today, and we'll submit those to you for a vote in December. Julie, tell me if I mess up here. We'll have a admission. So the hopefully you approve the recommendations in December. What happens then is that we have an administrative rule hearing where comments are provided or welcome, and you'll actually, I think we have to do something in November. Anyway, then we will have you do the final recommendation to move forward, and they will hopefully be effective December 31st. Is that right, Julie?
If we can get there. And I know we have to separate, you know, some of these changes. Some of them require statutory change, so they'll need to be completely separated from this initial process. But the smaller changes that don't require statutory change, with your approval today, can move forward. So we can draft this final language, we can get it out for public comment, post it in the Oregon Bulletin, go through all of the, we have to send it to the legislature, and it goes everywhere. There's a long process that goes with rule changes. So, but it will absolutely have, like the board has a hearing, for example, unless you choose not to, but I don't know that that's ever not happened.
Right.
Okay, so I guess, with all that said, so then are we taking a vote on 10? Given that we've made some recommendations for changes, do we still take a vote, Angie, to move this forward?
You at least have votes to approve to initiate the rulemaking process as directed.
Okay. So is there a vote or is there a motion to move this through the process, the rulemaking process?
Excuse me, Nancy. I just want to make sure I understand. I'd like to make a public comment related to the AP exam change. Is that time already passed or not happened yet?
No, that would be during the comment period once we actually publish the rules.
So not today?
Not today.
Okay. Okay, so do we have a motion to move Chapter 10 through the rulemaking process?
I make a motion to move Chapter 10 to the rulemaking process.
This is due, I'll second it.
Okay. So with the feedback that we've given to the board for some changes, those in favor state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, motion is passed. We'll go to chapter 40.
Yes. It shouldn't take too long. On page 1, 2 little a, we changed. Licensees whose principal place of business is located in another jurisdiction, the new language says, and who holds an active license in that jurisdiction may meet the ethics requirement of this rule by demonstrating compliance with their own state's ethics requirements.
Kim, just a comment there is that it looks right above that in item friend D that we've got the credit for nano learning included in chapter 40. So that's, I just want to point that out. I know that there was a question, I think it was coming from Sherry, but that we do have that in there. So anyways, keep going.
Page 2, we just took off the effective period of July 1, 2020, since that is long past now. The manual learning. So the only change, no, there's not really a change there. So page 4.
Cosmetic. No.
It's a cosmetic. Yeah. So this is all pretty, just, there's nothing substantial here at all. But on page 10, this is regarding CPE audits. We added the language that says licensees who do not respond to the CPE audit by the date specified in the notice or who do not correct deficiencies by the date specified in the deficiency letter will be suspended until the CPE audit is concluded. The licensee shall incur civil penalties outlined in OAR 801-10-00106 little c. The board, in its discretion, may grant a request for extension for CPE audit response for reasons of health certified by a doctor that prevents the licensee from submitting their CPE materials, or a licensee on active military duty, or other good cause to be determined by the board on a case-by-case basis. Request for extension must be submitted in writing on a form provided by the board prior to the end of the audit period or as soon as reasonably able, and must include documentation supporting the conditions for extension.
And I guess back to Jason's earlier comment on that, or as soon as reasonably able is a little
bit. Okay.
So I like
the wording in here. I'm glad that you guys put this in there. But should A, B, C, D be small letter? That's a minor thing.
Okay, I'll look at that.
And should D be 5? Because it's actually not a reason.
Oh. Yeah.
Or.
I like that. Okay. Got it.
Sorry for the English.
It's I for kid. Thank you. Next is page 11, where we talk about waivers. We just added the language on request for waivers. A request for a waiver of CPE requirements must be submitted in writing for each renewal period during which the conditions for waiver exist and include documentation supporting the conditions for waiver. Last but not least is page 12, active licensees, CPE penalties. We have current language that says licensees who submit an application for renewal of an active license and who have not complied with the CPE requirements described in Division 40 are required to complete and report an additional 16 hours. The new language also says active licensees who do not meet the 24 annual requirement but completed the 80-hour requirement by June 30 may indicate the deficiency on a renewal form and use a CPE penalty forgiveness request form to avoid the 16-hour penalty. A CPE penalty forgiveness request
may only be used once during any three consecutive renewal periods. CPE penalty forgiveness request will not be approved for renewals submitted after June 30th.
Is this for is the forgiveness request part, is that something that we currently have?
No, this is a whole new idea of processing applications who are deficient. We're giving them like a one pass.
And this is brand new for your consideration?
Yes, brand new.
There are other states that do this. They take a hard line on CPE penalties, but they allow like a one-time, you know, get out of jail free card. So, you know, you messed up once here, we'll forgive you, and next time you get no waiver at all.
And there's people that are consistently getting these penalties, and it just doesn't matter to them. And it takes a lot of extra work on staff when we have to dock them and get them a letter and follow up with them and still not get it. So it's maybe.
So they can use it once in a 6-year period of time.
That's correct.
So when life happens, you know, and sometimes things happen.
Mm-hmm. And do we have the mechanism internally to track this? Yes.
Yes, we do.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this component?
I'm just glad you asked if this was in there because I kept looking for this last night. What the heck? I didn't know I could do this.
Yeah.
So, okay.
Just
kidding. Wrapping my head around this was a little strange. I was like, I didn't. Really? Okay. I guess we're playing Monopoly.
Sorry. It's actually an attempt to be nice, to recognize that life happens sometimes and that, you know, CPE shouldn't be an afterthought, right? But sometimes you can't get everything in by June 30th. So if you're forthcoming and say, hey, something happened, I need forgiveness.
Well, this is the way this is written. The only thing that you've done is that if a person didn't get their 24-hour annual requirement, but got the 80-hour, so they still got it all in. They just didn't get it, you know, that 24 minimum in a single year. All we're saying here is that there may be opportunity to waive the additional 16 hours, but they still have to have met the 80 hours. We're not allowing them to go short on the 80 hours. Okay.
And if there's any changes you want to see to this, I mean, this is all brand new. It was just conceptual from, you know, seeing what other jurisdictions are doing and that, you know, seems to be working for them.
Do you have an example of the forgiveness request form?
No, yeah, it was brand new.
It doesn't exist yet. You have to. Let's be naked.
Okay.
Can't make like this, since it was for consideration. If you say no, we don't like this, then we didn't prepare any forms yet.
Yeah. Jeremiah, did you have anything with Division 40?
I do not think I had anything.
Okay.
And Kim, I think there's one last section there.
Yeah, it's for inactive licensees. It's the same concept. Licensees who don't meet the 32-hour requirement by June 30th indicate the deficiency, and they can ask for forgiveness as well. So they don't get the 8-hour penalty.
Okay. Any further discussion on Chapter 40? Is there a motion to move this through the rulemaking process?
I'll make a motion to move Chapter 40 to the rulemaking process.
Just do all second.
Okay. All in favor state aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay, we're moving forward. Okay, so I guess I have a clarification question here. Since we just talked about those four, so the educational requirements for a CPA exam, do we need to make another vote on that? We've already reviewed the memo and it's included in the process, the rulemaking that's been proposed. So do we need another vote on that?
I don't know. I don't know why.
Okay. And so I guess that's the same thing for the reciprocity and the firm registration. I feel like we've kind of really nailed those. So I don't, it doesn't feel like we needed another, yet another vote on this.
Great.
Okay, so public comment. Elizabeth, you have your hand up.
Sorry, mouse problems there. I know, I just had the question regarding the AP credit, trying to understand that, but I'll obviously defer that. And I believe that Logan Steele has had some comments.
Hello, thanks, Elizabeth. So I'm Logan Steele here. I'm the accounting program director at OSD. So just a couple of points to bring up about the analytics issue. Thanks for letting us speak, first of all, and for considering the issue. So we actually have five students right now, or recent students. They just graduated in June, and they've been ruled ineligible for the exam. And the difficulty is with waiting for any kind of rule change. They can't start their full-time positions with their firms in the normal way. So not to work on an hourly basis. It's creating a lot of hardship for them. And I'm wondering if the board, if there's any capacity to consider a temporary ruling. To let accounting analyst courses count towards the core requirement. That's the key issue here. They have enough related credits, they just don't have the core requirements because of the accounting analyst course not being counted.
Yeah, Logan, I appreciate that. And that actually, I don't know when you dropped in, but we actually talked about that, about the folks, you know, what we can do while we're waiting for the rules. And so Kimberly and other board staff already have that direction, so I think we're all on the same page there.
Fantastic. And then just the second point would be the kind of the question of the process around determining whether an analyst course is core in accounting or more of a general requirement related item, maybe. And there's two reasons I think you can just use the designation from the universities of the course title. So for accounting courses, they have to cover accounting topics. We will not label them accounting courses if they do not. Reasons are AACSP accreditation. Our accreditors come through and review these things. I think even more prominently, and this applies to all universities, not just ones that are accredited, departments fiercely protect their turf. And the university rules on these things. We could not offer an accounting class covering statistics. It just would not work. Right, it has to be accounting. Otherwise, you know, there will be a faculty fight. So maybe in conjunction with reviewing the learning objectives or the course catalog description, I think that would probably get you where you need to be.
Yeah, and again, I'm not sure when you joined in the meeting, but that was specifically something that we talked about earlier. In that, you know, we don't want to be so literal that it has, you know, that it's just about the title, but you have to look at the substance of the course itself and take that into consideration specifically as it relates to the Oregon universities. And so I think that's another point that we're all on the same page on.
Okay.
Sherry, I see that you have your hand up.
Yes, thank you. And I'll save some of my thoughts for the public comments that come later. But I do appreciate the fact that you've allowed us to provide feedback here. Real quick, in the eligible programs in Division 40 on page 4, up at the top, I am asking that you provide an opportunity to add 0.5 credits back in for group study, individual study, and blended. That is in keeping with model rules for a NASPA CPE standards. And there was 0.5 option for group study previously to the last rule changes. That was a 0.5 first. I'm asking that it be tied more towards model rules or standards, where it would be once the CPA earns one credit, which would be 50 contact minutes, then additionally they would be able to earn 0.5, so every 25 minutes thereafter. So it will be one credit, 1.5, two credits, 2.5, etc. So I'm asking that. The indication in nano learning does not apply to group study. Those other areas up above, if you see in the rules, it's very clear about you know, each credit hour is 50 content minutes. So Nano is...
Sure, where are you putting it?
Okay, I'm talking about page 4 down on page item 6 under Nano Learning. That is not applying to the other areas of group study, the individual blended up above. Those areas up above relate to the employment. The programs that qualify are 50 contact minutes. And I would be happy to, you know, collaborate them. It's detailed. Once you get into the credit, you have to go over to page 7 at the top, where it talks about credit hours in credit hours. Eligible CPE credit is measured by program length with 150-minute period equal to 1 CPE credit. It doesn't allow in group study, individual study, or blended, unless they're a Nano course, it does not allow that 0.5 credit any longer. Again, that disappeared in the January 2020 rules.
Nancy, can I clarify? This is Julie.
Yeah.
Sherry, what you're asking would actually be more restrictive than what we're doing right now. So, section 50 in Division 40, number 1, credit hours, is just saying that we measure everything based on a 50-minute hour. So we literally now are allowing 0.1, 0.2, 0.3, 0.4, 0.5, 0.6. We're allowing all of that, not limited to 0.5. We removed the restriction to allow only 0.5 after 1 full credit. So we've actually now going through these first 2 renewal cycles since this happened, we're now allowing a lot more credit than we were ever able to do before.
It's not clear in the rules, respectfully, Julie. I can't give the number, but I have a number of members complaining to me that they can no longer take the 0.5, and we do not want to put anyone in harm's way. So, frankly, you know, there's programming out there nationally that would give, for example, 1.5. We just had an example of working on it on something recently. We said, we're not going to be offering the 1.5 because it's not clear, and we don't want there to be a misinterpretation when all of us that are in the room are no longer in the room. Mm-hmm. So, any comment versus anything less than 50 contact minutes only appears in Nano Learning program on page 4. It doesn't appear elsewhere in the rules. So, I'm just asking for some clarification, and I would be happy for the society to jump into this, and collaborate with you on language. I suspect OAIA might be interested as well, but not students to that. So thank you for the comment and being able to comment.
And thank you, Sherry. And so to board staff, let's relook at the language there and see if we can provide clarification so that there isn't a misunderstanding and folks do understand that we are actually counting more credits than what we had before. I want to recognize that Ray Johnson has joined us, and Ray, is there anything that you would like to share?
Thank you, Nancy, and I apologize for coming in late. I just got one comment that I would like to share at this point, and this goes back to the conversation that we've had regarding accounting hours versus what's currently titled accounting and or related subjects. You've got 24 semester hours in accounting. When you look at the UAA, and so I'm looking at the top of page 16 of 38 in Division 10, item C, where it says a minimum of 24 semester hours or 36 quarter hours in accounting or related subjects. The UAA really says that second bucket, item C, would be 24 semester hours or 36 quarter hours in business. And it defines a variety of business subjects, which are laid out here. I think it would be a much brighter line for everyone if we have the accounting bucket and then the business bucket. You may have talked about this earlier, and I apologize if that wasn't brought out. But I think that's the way students look at it. That's the way university faculty look at it. That's the way the UAA looks at it. I think if instead of saying in accounting or related subjects, if we said in business subjects, and then business subjects are defined as business finance, economics, data analytics, written and oral communication. And it'd just be clearer for everybody, and I think it would be helpful in terms of trying to distinguish between the accounting and business. I think Logan made a very clear argument about the challenge of that we all live with in higher education in terms of what becomes an accounting course versus a business course. It'd just be clear for everybody.
Mm-hmm. So you're saying, so I'm looking at page 16 of 38, item C, a minimum of 24 semester hours and 36 quarter hours in accounting and for related subjects. The related subjects are defined as business, finance, economics, data analytics, and oral written communication. And you're saying, what you're saying is that we should consider removing the word accounting and just say in business-related subjects.
That's correct. And then make the next sentence, you know, when it says related subjects, just say business is defined as, you know, and then you could say business administration, finance, economics, et cetera.
If we were to write it that way, then would that eliminate consideration of any additional accounting courses that an individual may take?
I don't believe it would. I think it would keep a brighter line. I can look at that one more time, but when you look at the UAA has two categories. One is accounting, mm-hmm. One is business, right?
Yeah, and I think I'm following you.
And if you want to be clear, you could say, you know, an accounting, you know, I mean, for example, you would potentially, your intro to accounting could potentially fall into the business. It's not going to fall into the accounting area, right? Because that's...
Yeah, wouldn't be the core accounting.
Right. If you wanted to add another sentence that an accounting course that doesn't meet the core accounting requirement could count in the business bucket, but... Generally, students fill up that business bucket pretty well and pretty quickly. It's the accounting bucket that is really, and you want to try and put a bright line between the two buckets, and there's not a bright line right now.
To Nancy's point, I don't know how, my understanding is that if there's excess upper division accounting hours, those get classified by board staff as the other bucket. So I don't know how frequently that happens, but that's consideration, Nancy, I think is correct, to make sure that those excess accounting hours still are able to land in the second bucket.
Yeah, I just don't want to in C to be eliminating any additional accounting. I mean, there's some people who take a lot of accounting courses, and they might fulfill the entire requirement just with accounting. God bless them if they do. But I just don't want us to write some language in C that's going to eliminate the consideration of any other accounting courses. So with that stated, then you know, maybe a sentence that said, you know, any accounting. That it still could be accounting beyond the core, right? Or business-related subjects. Julie, Kim, do you guys, can you propose some language there? I lost Kim on my screen. Oh, there you are.
can say that we do frequently see additional accounting courses that currently, with the language that we have being related, that we allow all the lower division accounting courses that students see. So accounting 211, for example, is, you know, is on pretty much every transcript we see.
Right.
And I guess the question is there a reason why we wouldn't want to better align with the language being business-related subjects so that there's more alignment and, you know, less inconsistency between, you know, information that students receive? I just think that a better alignment is better than using the same language.
I really am more concerned with the subject matter that's identified there, not the language. I mean, you know, the language is important, I understand, but I'm more focused on the subject matter that's allowed. And so any language change that would eliminate our ability to accept other accounting courses would probably have a very bad effect on a lot of students.
Yeah, I appreciate the side effect you're talking about, and I'll think about that and provide a more specific comment during the comment period.
Yeah, that would be good. Thank you. Thank you, Ray. Okay, other public comment?
Nancy, is it possible to just provide 2 minutes of background on PNP and CLEP?
Oh, that's fine.
Okay, so just for the folks who may not be as familiar with this, AP credits have been increasing tremendously in among students. And if you look at the topics provided, AP exams are a college-level course with a college-level curriculum that is taught in the high school, and then students upon completion have the choice to take an proficiency exam that is administered by the AP board. If the students achieve a certain score, they can request that their university accept those credits. And so it's at the university's discretion whether they will accept credits. The vast majority of these courses are humanities, language, science, and math. They're not business courses. So these go towards gen ed credits for students. Not all universities accept them. Not all universities, they also make a distinction between accepting these for credit versus checking the box on a specific requirement. So for example, in the sciences, many of those classes at rigorous programs, Oregon State Engineering is one of them, will not accept certain AP courses to check the box on a requirement. They just shove those credits in your elective bucket, if you will. So there's a very clear, very rigorous process on those. Those are college-level credits. There's really, it's just not really a distinction. And it doesn't affect the accounting. CLEP is very different. CLEP is somebody can just go in and take an exam administered by the college board. And if they pass it, the college board says, you've achieved this proficiency. These are much less widely used, and they are much less widely accepted by I would say more rigorously accredited universities. They are used. This is something that, just to punctuate how important these are, this is utilized heavily by students to hit their 150 hours, and there is a cost differential. I just looked up the cost. AP exams are about $100 per course. That would cost you in excess of $1,000 at a public in-state institution to take that equivalent course. So you're talking about 10 times the cost. So I just wanted the whole board to have that understanding of what is going on there. These are well screened by universities. They generally do not affect the specific requirements related to the CPA exam. These are gen ed, and this has the potential to have a tremendously disproportionate effect on it's an equity issue for students because of the cost. I'm happy to answer any more questions either here or offline on this.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Is there any other public comment? Okay, any comments by the board at this time? Okay, with that, I'm going to call the public session, or call to, or the executive session under the authority of ORS 19.660.2.F.H. for consideration of records exempt from public disclosure and counsel advice. So, Julie, can you help us? And then once we're done with executive session, we will be coming back into public session for matters discussed in executive session. And I'm not sure what time that will be, but board staff can coordinate with you if you wish to come back to the public session later this afternoon.
In the meantime, we'll place everybody into the waiting room.
Can we take a break first before we go into executive session?
Or yes, we can.
I know, Nancy.
Well, I know, sorry, I just keep going. Let's take a 10-minute break. It is 10:56, so we'll be back.
So, because we have to go into executive session in public session, so just go on. Because it's gone into executive session now.